This is Abe Partridge in Mobile, Alabama, and this is a song I wrote called The Black Flag T-Shirt Lament. I hope you like it. The neon lights cry and fill the silence of the night, as the falsely civilized come to seek their thrills, and the Holy Ghost roams these dripping streets alone. But he can't find a single heart to steal. It's just another smiling face and a phony handshake, as them posers fill the art district streets. So I just smile back, ashamed of the whole act. That's the price I pay for being part of the scene. Black flag t-shirt from a designer in New York, that in an act of rebellion you bought off Amazon, and you covered your jacket with reproduction band patches that you never listened to even when you were young. But I could love enough for the both of us, but it's getting harder for me to count the cost. Because with every dirty dollar, man, I'm beginning to wonder if there's any purity left in my great heart. Nero may have played his fiddle, but Rome rotted from the middle, and folks have a way of weaving myths into tales. We know our story all so well. It was heroin and shotgun shells. To my generation's art died with Chris Cornell. Maybe it's the influences of my youth that gave me this jagged truth. Maybe it's my punk rock ideals. But this old hippie jam, it's a beach town trinket scam. And like Dylan, man, I'm stuck in Mobile. Up on crying, so it may appear that I ain't trying. It's just hard to be an artist in this town. So I'll curse here to try. I'll close my eyes and I'll sing to God, 'cause I knew you wouldn't listen anyhow. Oh yes, I knew you wouldn't listen anyhow.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Thank you for sharing, man.
Yeah, man.
Wave, thank you so much for hosting me today, man.
Yeah.
Having me over.
Thanks for coming over.
Yeah. So, Abe, originally born and raised here in Mobile?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What did that look like growing up? What part of Mobile were you from?
Well, my mother and father were together till I was 7 years old, and I was raised up out in Sims. And then my mother and father split up, and then my mother
moved into city, and then my father stayed out in Sims, and so. And then I went to a different school just about every year. I'm pretty sure going, if I went back and actually looked, I'm pretty sure every single year I was in a different school, because we constantly drifted around. Spent a little time over in Mississippi when I was younger. I think second or third grade or something like that. And we went up to Mississippi for a little while, and then when I finally finished high school at Davidson High School here in town.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So just like moving around different schools and all that as you were growing up. What about like friends?
Yeah, it's easy for me to make friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was always the new guy for a lot. Yeah, all through my younger, youth, until I got to high school, I was always the new kid.
So what were you into coming up? It wasn't music, right?
I played a lot of ball. I played a lot of football and baseball and basketball. And I played all three sports in school, and about 12 years old, I started like actually listening and loving music, but not playing or nothing,
Yeah.
And mostly just played ball and stuff like all the other kids do around here.
Yeah. What was that look like? Was it mom and dad's records, or different tastes for both of them, or what was it like?
Oh man, I'll be 40 this year, so I was born in 1980, and almost every kid that was born in the late 70s or the 1980, 81 or 82 even, we all listened to music at the same time, and that was when Nevermind was the rock and roll. So we all fell for that.
Mm-hmm.
I was just one of the millions of kids that fell for that.
Yeah, that Nevermind album, it seemed like it influenced just across the board.
Man, how old are you?
I'm 30.
Oh, okay, yeah. So
It was a bit before me.
No, man.
But I was still influenced by
yeah,
it.
Yeah, right. No, not saying that you can't be influenced by it, but I remember coming up, and I remember music, and it was it was Michael Jackson. He was the king of pop,
mm-hmm.
and Michael Jackson was on the Coca-Cola commercials, and he was like the star.
Mm-hmm.
And so my familiarity with what music was Michael Jackson and a bunch of people that sounded like Michael Jackson on the radio. Because I wasn't really interested, right? I was just a kid, and that I just like, boy, that sucks. I hated it. And then what I knew about rock and roll was Guns N' Roses and Poison and just other just absolute shit,
Riding Dad's car.
Yeah, hair band shit, right? And then, so when Nevermind came out, and man, people have written books on this stuff, but when it came out, It was so anti-establishment, and I don't know, it was just something about it resonated. I guess it was it just resonated with me, as it did with all the kids in my generation. We all fell for that. And
I got a buddy of mine back home, he's in Columbus, Mississippi, and he said the moment he heard that album, it changed the way that he listened to music forever.
Oh, yeah, me too.
He said it's like it broke the chains on.
Yeah, well, it seemed pure. It seemed so pure, and even though looking back, if you even read anything about that record, they really didn't even like it because they thought it was too poppy. But if you grew up just with a vague understanding of what Top 40 radio was, that was as anti-establishment as you could get.
Uh-huh.
Of course there were a lot of things under that there was no internet, dude, so I was, and plus I was 12 years old, I wasn't like seeking out underground music in Selms, Alabama.
Right.
You know, and with no internet at 12 years old. So for a kid like me to hear a band like Nirvana was an unreal kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. What about, what else is good? Like after finding Nirvana?
Oh, well then, you know, that led me down this whole path, man. I mean, of course, the whole grunge era, you know, I just dove into all that. And so we had this great, I just head over heels for rock and roll after that. And then, so we just read liner notes, you know. And then, you know, like, you read, like, you know, you get the Pearl Jam record and you read about who they think and the credits in the back of the CD cover, you know. And then you go, we had this great record store here in Mobile. It was over by the University of South Alabama. It's called Satori Sound. It's now a coffee shop and a little venue. They have a little venue there. I've actually played a show there before, but they had this place called Satori Sound Records, and you could go there, and they had all the underground stuff, like the stuff that Blockbuster Music or whatever never heard of. And so you could go in there and get all these like imported records, and so like there would be like 12 Nirvana records of just unreleased stuff and live tracks and stuff that you could, that I think may have been illegal. I don't know. But we would go there. And then, so, you know, I went down that trail for a long time, and then at Satori they had all this old school punk stuff. And, you know, I got, like, into the Cramps and the Germs and Minor Threat. And, you know, I started, because that was all the guys that they were influenced by, right? The grunge era is influenced by that. And so I just, you know, I fell in love with just punk rock and grunge. And, you know, they called it alternative rock back in those days. Mm-hmm. But that's really, like, what turned me on to music. And then so from there, you know, then I'm like, well, my dad's records were pretty cool, you know. He had like he had all the Beatles, you know, and I remember growing up, my dad made a cassette of a White Album. He taped the White Album from his record player and he put it by my crib. And so when I first heard the White Album, when I was like, I was probably 16 years old or something, and I was like actually listening to it to enjoy music, and I was like, wait a minute, this is children's music. And I thought it was like, I thought this was like kids' music, like a Disney thing or something. And my dad's like, no, I put the White Album on a tape, you know, in your crib when you were, because I remember hearing that when I was like 2 or 3 years old.
Yeah, it's coming back.
Yeah. Have you seen those little piggies in there? You know, it sounds like a kid's song, right? Yeah. I mean, why don't we do it in the road? Maybe not. But still, when I was a kid, when you hear why don't we do it on the road, it sounds like a kid's song. Yeah. Yeah, let's play out in the road. But yeah, so then I was like, man, the Beatles are awesome. So I started listening to the Beatles, and then like my dad had all these Zeppelin records and the Doors, and I mean, you know, dude, I mean, we could name all the old classic rock bands, but they're all good, you know. And so, I just went down rock and roll for a long time, you know.
So what about like after high school, was sports anything that you would be trying to pursue, or like what was college, or
I was okay at baseball. I was better at baseball than I was anything else, and I like every kid, you know, I dreamed of, you know, I'm gonna go play with pros, you know, like,
hell yeah.
But And I spent, dude, I spent many, 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 many hours hitting in a batting cage, pitching, and, you know, all that growing up. But when I was about a senior in high school, I realized that I didn't have the dedication that was required, because I had made it for so long just on, you know, I got good hand-eye coordination. Yeah. And then I finally made it to the point to where you had to actually have more than hand-eye coordination.
Yeah.
The guys that play after that, there's a certain level of dedication that they have, and I didn't have that. And it was a crushing thing, really, because, you know, you grow up and you spend your first 17, 18 years of your life
doing something.
Yeah. And then you realize,
with the boys.
Yeah. And then you, man, this ain't going to work, so... Yeah, I kind of gave up on that around senior in high school. I realized, man, my buddies had some colleges looking at them, and they wasn't looking at me, so
it was about six of us. We grew up playing park ball, you know, starting out 4 or 5 years old.
Oh, yeah.
All the way up to, you know, 13, 14, then it's time to play for your high school. And I remember seventh grade, I went out for the team, and I was the only one that didn't make it.
Oh, no.
And the assistant coach was a good friend of my dad. What was the problem? Your son didn't have the arm. Like, we got him to crow hop out and left, not that we was going to put him out there, but he couldn't make it to home in two bounces. Get him to work on the arm, get him to come out next year. His bat, everything was fine, just his arm.
Yeah.
And went out, you know, the next year and made the team, and it was fine. But right there, I realized quick that, you know what? And that was the year I picked up playing guitar.
Yeah.
I put my glove down and picked the guitar up. I was like, I can enjoy this for life.
Yeah.
But I know baseball is just, hey, 12th grade, it's over.
Uh-huh.
It's not going anywhere.
Well,
else.
For 90% of us, it is, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
I played ball, speaking about ball, you know, I played ball as from like 5 years old all the way up, a lot, many years on the same team. When, his dad actually was our coach, old Jake Peavy, you know.
Yeah.
So I remember playing T-ball and coach pitch and all that with him and out at Municipal Park when we were little kids. He was always better than everybody else too, even as a kid. Mm-hmm. You know, he just had a, and his dad was, my God, his dad was like, that's all they did, the boys, all they did. He had a little brother named Luke. They still live here in town.
We had one guy who graduated a few years before I did. Only, I guess, person noteworthy of mention. He went on scholarship to play baseball at Alabama. And first season there, tore his rotator cuff.
Oh, man.
And he was a catcher.
Yeah.
And it never was the same.
Yeah, it is.
That, and that was heartbreaking because, you know, the whole town was excited.
Yeah.
That one of us finally got out.
Uh-huh. And that's why, you know, that, not speaking about him specifically, but and generally, that's why you see so many guys down, you know, you go out into the bar and you guys talking about their old high school days. Is that's because that's their, that was a lot of them's glory days.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because things didn't work out so well after that, you know. But those sports, man.
Yeah.
Oh, this is the first interview I ever did about sports, so this is cool.
Yeah. So what did it look like after high school? The ball was coming to an end?
Yeah, man. So I had this, I had like a religious kind of, I was like, you know, so I told you, my mom and my dad split up, mm-hmm. you know, and just kind of, we'd go to church, you know, sporadically in fits. And then not for a while, and then we went to a lot of different things, you know.
I was going
to
ask, like, denomination-wise, was it typically Baptist?
Most of the time Baptist, I would say, yeah. But sometimes Methodist. But, yeah, we would, that's, you know, we've been to the Charismatic, and, I mean, we were all over through my youth. And then when I was 18, you know, it came time to figure out what I want to do in my life. And you know, my mindset at that time was I felt like that was a noble thing to do. But looking back on it, you know, I was just looking for some kind of stability.
Yeah.
And so I went to the church and I started going to this church, and this preacher said, hey, you should go to Bible college, you know.
Yeah.
And so I was like, all right, that sounds like a thing to do, you know, because I didn't really have anything else that I was really wanting to do. And so I did, and I went the first one, about got kicked out of it. And because I, you know, most people in those colleges come from that church. Mm-hmm. It was an independent fundamental Baptist church is where I ended up at. And I didn't grow up that way.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of problems.
Cut off the same cuff or whatever.
Yeah. I had a lot of problems with the rules at first. But yeah, that's what I did. Finally, I went to four of them in 4 years.
Okay. And so after that, preached.
I was preaching, yeah. I started preaching after all that.
During all that, just the idea of echo chamber, that was one thing that I picked up. I went to University of Mobile and did some work over in New Orleans after that. I used to be in the missions real heavy.
You was a preacher?
No, I was going to do missions.
What is a missions?
Like a missionary.
A missionary is a preacher, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we'd say that.
Yeah.
I never would have any interest in like a flock. I would be interested in doing like a church plant, like creating the church.
Oh, okay. Oh, cool. So that's why you went to the University of Mobile, because it was a Southern Baptist thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And the church that I went to in Kennedy, where I'm from, was Southern Baptist.
Okay,
so
yeah.
When it came time, that's where you go.
Yeah.
And so, that was one thing that I noticed, especially, graduating, and it kind of goes back to that fundamental thing that you're saying about the college, all these people were kind of the same.
Yeah, man. Well, I will tell you that you guys at the University of Mobile had way more freedom of thought than an independent fundamental Baptist ever would. They're called independent fundamental Baptists for a reason, and that's because they separate themselves from everybody who is not independent, fundamental, and Baptist. And Southern Baptists were just liberal, and
which is hard to believe for some.
Right, for you, yeah, right, because you probably are on a, and I now, I mean, you know, but most people are under the, most generally, people look at the Southern Baptist Church as a very conservative denomination, and it is.
Yeah.
But when you're an independent fundamental Baptist, you see the world in a whole different light.
Mm-hmm.
And you see a very small remnant of people that have a grasp on the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And you see a whole lot of people that don't. And the Southern Baptists we would have considered far too liberal, and because you had freedoms, right? You could have your hair maybe longer.
Yeah.
You could
have a beard. You know.
Yeah. Walk around with a beard. Your ladies could wear pants or
right.
Short. You could wear shorts. You know. You probably went to the movies. Y'all probably listened to all kinds of rock and roll music, or even if it was Christian music, it was influenced by rock and roll or whatever.
Yeah.
And all that would not fly, you know. And there's also like a very specific and literal interpretation of the scriptures that have to be maintained. And if you err from that, then
err too.
yeah, be gone, right?
Yeah.
Which is another reason why the Independent Fundamental Baptist is such a small denomination, because everybody that errs in even a very minor way,
you're out.
You're gone. You're no longer part of us. So, yeah, so saying that you were in an echo chamber, I mean, yes, I totally understand, but it was just a much smaller and narrow echo chamber that you get in when you're a part of a church like an independent fundamental Baptist. It's a hyper separationist kind of thing. It's really cultish, dude. You know, it's cultish. And for years I tried to say, it's not a cult. But then, you know, after you get out and you look, it's totally
it
a cult, man. I mean, because you're encouraged to separate from people who don't believe
the same way that you do.
Yeah. So I mean, to me that's a big mark. Like now, sitting on this side, if you're ever around people and they, you know, anybody that says you should separate from those folks because they don't believe a certain way, or separate from anybody for anything, dude. You know, it's just that's like a slippery slope, man. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what we're in Appalachian country, and you're married at this time preaching.
I went to school for 4 years, and then I married my wife on the day after I graduated.
Did you meet her there?
I met her at one of the Bible colleges that I went to. I went to this one called Crown College of the Bible, and right outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. And she came down from Maryland to attend school there, and I was up from Mobile attending school there, and we fell in love and
she went to school there for 1 year, and then she went back to Maryland, and I transferred to another college and then finished down in Georgia, Northwest Georgia, and bought her down. We got married the day after I graduated, and I went to basically working minimum wage jobs.
Just making ends meet, right?
Just making ends meet while trying and basically serving as like an understudy, I guess you know, like a just kind of being an understudy from this pretty prominent independent fundamental Baptist preacher up in Northwest Georgia. And I spent about 3 or 4 years there with him.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, like, was it during that time? Because you would shift gears, like, to finding a better way to make ends meet for your family and providing. But
no, man, I was. Our life was that church. So we lived in a little tiny trailer in a little place called Trimble Hollow, outside of Calhoun, Georgia, and the church that we were in, it had services Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, Saturday night.
Oh, wow.
And then that church also ran a camp, mm-hmm. a camp meeting, what they call an old-fashioned Holy Ghost camp meeting thing, right, mm-hmm. where people would come from all over, mostly around those parts, but there would be people come from all over, and they'd have camp meetings. So, in other words, you'd have preaching in the morning, you'd go eat. Preaching in the afternoon, you'd eat. Preaching at the night, and you'd be up to like 2 or 3 in the morning, and then you'd go back and do it again. And that we had 1 week meetings 3 times a year with them. And then during all this, we had revivals. We'd have maybe 1 revival every quarter or so.
Mm-hmm.
So if you actually pulled out a calendar, you was at church probably half the year.
Yeah.
You know, by the time you figured it all out, how many days you wasn't versus how many days you were. And so our whole life was that church, man. And I just went there and was, you know, helped in whatever way I could. I preached from time to time, and you know, helped serve, just free labor all the time at the camp, and doing
work. Whatever you could do to serve.
Yeah, while barely making ends meet. You know, living in a $320 a month trailer.
Yeah,
and my wife couldn't work because that was.
Yeah.
Women don't work. So my wife basically stayed at the trailer all day, tended to a bunch of, we had a bunch of chickens and we had a garden, and then I'd go out and work and then come home with, you know, my $8 an hour or whatever.
Yeah. So just after that, what would come next?
Well, then I took a church up in Kentucky. I got called to pastor this church up in Middlesboro, Kentucky, and I accepted it. That was one of, you want one of these?
Sure. Yeah, that'd be good. Thank you, man.
Whenever I was 25 years old, which was, you know, pretty young, but the independent Baptist churches are so small, you know, it's not really... I mean, the church in general is just so small. It wasn't that, I guess it was that far out of the ordinary, but yeah, I went and took a church in Middlesboro.
What was that like?
Well, I only did it for 2 years, so yeah. It wasn't that good.
Yeah, I couldn't, my first time that I ever preached, we were in Chile, in the capital, in Santiago. And I was told...
Oh, man, that's a long ways west. That's cold down there, ain't it?
Well, it was winter here, and it was summer there.
Oh, okay.
So we lucked out. No, actually, that's backwards. It was summer here and winter there. Because that was the cool thing about that trip was we're getting out of the heat for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told the night before, hey, this church needs somebody to speak. was going to see if you wanted to do it. And I had my best friend down there with me. He's like, you going to do it? And I said, why not? So, and that's why I say, like, earlier, I could not imagine, like, having a flock and having a church. And I could not imagine that.
Yeah. Man, you know, dude, I'm so far removed from that now, it's hard for me to imagine it, too. But at that time in my life...
It's just what it was.
Yeah, it's what I wanted. I was, you know... When I got called to pastor that church, I was pretty excited about it, you know. I'd never even been to Middlesbrough, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a... I don't know. It was bizarre. It was about 60 people or so there on my first Sunday when I went there, and I had a my boy was, I guess he would have been maybe 1.5, 2.
Okay.
And my little girl was just born, just a little newborn, and so went up there and. Had a Mercury Grand Marquis at that time, true preacher car, you know.
Yeah, man.
Like a Crown Victoria, but the Mercury one.
Mm-hmm.
I pulled up in there, and the church was it had started that the church building, not the church that was there, not the people, but the church building was an old snake handler church. And,
Another fact.
Actually, Middlesbrough, Kentucky has at least, I don't know about now because the feller died, but when I was living in Middlesbrough, Kentucky, this would have been 2005, 6, and 7. So, yeah. They had the largest snake handling church in America in Middlesbrough, Kentucky. And, The only reason I even knew that was because I was out going door to door in Middlesbrough passing out flyers and pamphlets for the church, you know. And I met this fella, I can't remember his last name. His first name was Jamie.
Yeah.
I can't remember his last name. Man, God, what was his last name? But he was missing one of his fingers from this knuckle on where a snake had bit him. And so, anyway, I was like, hey, I'm Abe Partridge. I'm from this Bright Star Baptist Church over here. And he's like, oh, I pastor this other church. And then he started telling me about snakes and all that. And he pointed to where they kept them. And he said, we have the largest snake handling church in America. And I was like, wow, yeah, and we talked for half an hour or so, and to go down that little trail for a second, Netflix, there's a special now, and that guy's on it, and he's dead now. They made it, but after I left there, they came in there and I bought a film crew,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't record him dying, but. I think after they made the show, he got bit in church, and they didn't believe that you're supposed to go to the doctor for nothing.
Right.
So he got bit, and it killed him. So that guy's dead now, and I was sitting there talking to him. It was the most surreal thing, seeing that video, you know, seeing that thing. And they were like, Middlesbrough, Kentucky. And I was like, man, this is where...
I spent a little bit of my time there.
Yeah, I know that guy.
Yes, I don't even know if there's a snake handler church in Lamar County anymore, but when my mom and dad were dating, my dad loves to tell the story that my mom's petrified of snakes.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he knew or if either one of them knew, but you know, service started and here comes the snake and they about to pass it around. And he said, right when that snake came out, he said, I never seen your mama move that fast. She was getting out of that church
yeah.
house.
Yeah, I don't do that, man.
That's some next level stuff.
It's unfortunate. I just read, have you ever read the Salvation on Santa Mountain, that book?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, you need to read that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's about a bunch of snake handlers in North Alabama. And actually, that fellow Jamie I was telling you about, he's written about in that book too. It's like, I didn't know it, but yeah, that fellow, I just met him on a whim, and then I've ended up seeing him
over the years.
Yeah, his name pops up because he was a very prominent figure in the snake handling churches. And you know, I met him on a whim just by accident one day. Didn't realize I was meeting somebody that was so important in that small, tiny subset of Christianity. But yeah, he was a really important figure. I don't know what happened to that church now. I really am tempted after reading that book, Salvation on Sand Mountain. I really want to go up there and see what happened to it. Because that book, Salvation on Sand Mountain, man, that was a crazy book. This guy wrote the book about, I think it was back in the 90s. There was a snake handling preacher up in North Alabama that ended up trying to murder his wife by getting her bit with some of the church snakes. And then so, yeah, it's crazy. This reporter starts doing a story on this preacher that, quote, backslid and then tried to murder his wife with a church snake. And then he ends up, like, getting into this band of snake handlers, this kind of roving band of snake handlers that just go up through the mountains and then he starts, like, believing this stuff, and he actually handles the snakes. And he thinks it's like God wants him to handle the snakes and stuff. And then, you know, he kind of comes to his senses. Mm-hmm. But the whole book is like his journey, like, into snake handling and out of it.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
crazy.
This.
Yeah, dude, it's crazy. It's a very interesting. Will Stewart told me to read that book.
There you go.
If you hear, on Will's last album released through Cornelius Chapel, there was a song on that record called Brush Arbor. And he wrote it about that song, and I love that song. And I was talking to him, I was like, dude, what's this about? Because I know the brush, they call them Brush Arbor meetings, and they did that, and the Independent Fundamental Baptist did that too. And Will's like, well, I wrote that song about this book I read called Salvation on Sand Mountain. Mm-hmm. So he's the reason I read it. But
there you go.
Yeah, it's a great book.
So just after pastoring, where would you go from there?
Well, so the church, you know, it was like, it was falling apart, really. And the church was falling apart while I was falling apart, because I was removed from the echo chamber that I was in while I was going through college, while I was the understudy at the church in Northwest Georgia. I moved up to Kentucky outside of all those other influences. And then it was a discovery of myself is what was happening. And I just decided, I had actually came to Mobile. I was in my mom's house, and I was visiting. And I woke up one morning, and I got up in my bed, and I looked at my wife, and I said, we're going to go back, and I'm going to resign. And resigning in an Independent Fundamental Baptist church, to resign or to leave the ministry is, it's like spiritual suicide, basically, you know. Uh-huh. Because I knew that it was going to lead to the complete removal of all that. You know, we're gonna pull up a lot, you know, basically everybody in my life at that time that wasn't my immediate family. For 9 years had been Independent Fundamental Baptist, and so we lost every friend, every mm-hmm. people that I loved, you know. I mean, I genuinely loved them.
Those are people that you were doing life with for 9 years, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so but yeah, we went up there, I just quit, and but you know, man, I was at my wit's end, dude. I was emotionally I couldn't feel nothing, hadn't felt anything for a long time. Just despondent.
Mm-hmm.
Uninterested, uninterested in anything, uninterested in the in any kind of church service. I was just burnt out, dude, you know. And so anyway I just left. We moved back here and I started working for minimum wage again. Mm-hmm. I got a job working minimum wage, but this time I had two children and I was living in Mobile where there ain't no $320 trailers. And so I didn't know what to do, you know, and so I joined the military to make a living.
Mm-hmm. After, I don't know if you want to go into that at all, but I'm just, after military, that would be when songwriting would come.
Well, now songwriting and painting and all that, this started all in Kentucky when I was pastoring in Kentucky.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I just didn't do it publicly.
Okay.
Yeah. What happened was, is I was up in, I was in Kentucky talking with snake handlers, you know, and preaching to, my first Sunday, you know, we had 60. My second Sunday, we had about 20. I'd split the church my first Sunday. And then, you know, those 20 whittled down to nearly nothing. Mm-hmm. And then there were many Sundays where Sundays and Wednesdays that I preached to no one but my wife and my two children. And then we built it back up over a period of time to where we had about 60 again. And I won't tell you on a tape because I don't harbor any animosity. And toward anybody up there, and I would, but I'll tell you later why the church broke up again. I broke it up, and we went down to 5 people or something. And so I left, and while this was all happening, Middlesbrough, Kentucky got high-speed internet access, and so we got AT&T high-speed internet access in 2007. And I discovered YouTube, right? And I had become obsessed with this guy named Son House, you know. So musically, you know, I grew up on this rock and roll and stuff. But then when I became Independent Fundamental Baptist, all that had to go.
Yeah.
So I had to stop listening to rock and roll. And
preferably burned or trash, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's what you're supposed to do. I sold mine at a pawn shop. But you were supposed to burn them, you know. But I didn't burn mine because I deemed them too bad. I think I got $200 or something for my CD collection, you know.
Yeah.
So I took them all down to the pawn shop and sold them. And then when I was going to Bible colleges and stuff, I was up, golly, man, this is a winding tale. But so when I was going to Bible college, I was in this one in Chattanooga, and I went into a pawn shop and bought a banjo on a whim. Because I saw somebody playing a banjo, I thought, man, that was awesome.
At that time, did you know how to play any instruments?
I didn't know how to play anything, nothing. And I bought a banjo when I was 18 years old, and I took it back to the dormitory, and I'd go to class, and I'd come back and play that banjo. And I'd go to class, I'd come back and play the banjo until I learned how to play the banjo. I learned how to play from this book, Earl Scruggs' 5-string banjo book. You know, you just read it and do what it says, and you just practice it over and over and over, and you learn all these roles, you know. And so I learned how to play a bluegrass style 5-string banjo.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's all these bluegrass festivals up there, and so I started going to these bluegrass festivals because bluegrass is funny, man, because Independent Fundamental Baptists they're okay with bluegrass because there's a lot of gospel in it.
Yeah.
And a lot of their
old brother were out there.
Yeah.
Old brother were out there kind of thing.
Yeah. There are a lot. There's so much gospel in it, man. I mean, even like Bill Monroe, and like the Stanley Brothers, and you know all those old like Jimmy Martin, and you know Jimmy Martin was just a raving drunk asshole, but then he would sing like you know Farther Along and stuff. You know he'd like pull a real gospel record out.
Yeah.
Bill Monroe too. You know these guys were like heathens, but they had gospel records, and so. And in the church, you know, the kind of music that we played in Independent Fundamental Baptist Church was very bluegrass, old-time country style, you know, three chords kind of stuff. So anyway, I would go to these band. I was going to these bluegrass festivals, and I was picking with all these old men. I just picked with old men out in the parking lots of these things, and that's how I learned to play music. And I would do that. I mean, almost every weekend, I'd be driving to find a place to
just go play
to play my banjo with a bunch of old dudes primarily. And then when I went up to school in Knoxville, there was this place called Ciderville Music Store. Mm-hmm. And this guy was, the guy that owned it was some famous banjo player. And I used to go down in there, and, you know, they'd have pickings every Saturday night. So I'd just go in there and pick with these old guys playing bluegrass music. And so, So I was playing music. I was playing it in church, right, and at bluegrass festivals and stuff. Well, and I learned how to play old time banjo with like claw hammer stuff, and I was doing that some too. And then I got high speed internet access, and I started, you know, looking at all these videos that you could never watch before. Uh-huh. You know, the world before YouTube was a very different world, man, because you'd have to tape stuff off the TV on the off chance that the TV actually played something worth taping, you know? Yeah. And now you can just watch any clip of anything that you've ever imagined existed, you know, it's there, and it's amazing. But, you know, in 2007, so back about 2004, I went to a flea market and I bought this VHS of I was really unfamiliar with blues music. Uh-huh. You know, I didn't really... I thought, you know, blues was... I just, like, had scenes from movies I'd seen. Like, old black guys playing guitars, you know, woke up this morning stuff, right? I saw this video for $1. It was called Legends of the Country Blues. It had this guy Sun House on it. And so I'm watching this... I took it home and I watched it, and I was mesmerized by it. And I watched the thing over and over and over and over, because Son House was a Baptist preacher. He started as a Baptist preacher as a kid, and then he ended up leaving the church and becoming a bluesman. Mm-hmm. And he's the only bluesman that is known of that did it that way. There was a lot of guys like Skip James, and there were several others that started off as bluesmen, and then in their later years they became ministers or preachers or something.
But not that way.
He went
opposite.
He was the opposite. And I became enthralled with that. And his performance was, he would sit down with a guitar and his eyes would roll back in his head, and he would just go into this trance, and he would just beat out these blues songs. And it was like the devil was chasing him while he's singing them, you know. And then he would stop, and he would just mumble. And he would mumble for like nine or ten minutes about stories of talking about God, talking about the Bible, talking about the devil, talking about the blues, and it was just like an otherworldly kind of figure, you know. And I was obsessed with him.
Yeah, that was that same thing like with Robert Johnson, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't think it was to that extent.
Robert Johnson learned to play from some Son House.
I don't doubt it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's who. Yeah. And I think Son House even, like, I've read that he even may have started the whole Crossroad thing, because he was...
The legend?
Yeah, because Robert Johnson, he learned how to play guitar from Son House, and then he became better than Son House, and then he got the spotlight that Son House didn't get, and some of the spotlight that he... Anyway. So 2007 rolled along. I'm playing bluegrass music. I'm playing church, you know, in the church, playing banjo, playing. I learned how to play a little rhythm guitar. Well, then the first thing I do is I'm like, man, I'm finding some Son House videos.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm finding Carter Brothers videos, Stanley Brothers videos. I'm finding Carter Family videos and stuff like that. I'm just really interested in this old music. Hillbilly music and blues music, Skip James. Well, then I found out, man, all these guys like played this thing called the Newport Folk Festival, and they had made videos of this back in the 60s. And so I'm watching these Newport Folk videos, and then I see this young Bob Dylan, you know, singing these songs. I'm like, they're blown away, you know. I had never heard Bob Dylan before, and like, I think my dad had a couple of his records, but I never got it. And then I was sitting here looking at it, and it was blows my mind, you know. And so I just get obsessed with things, and which is a blessing and a curse. But I got obsessed with Bob Dylan for a while, and then, you know, if you go down that trail on YouTube, you end up at like Townes Van Zandt and John Prine and Guy Clark and all these guys. Mm-hmm. And so I'm discovering all this stuff while I'm going through the just absolute. You know, I'm going in an absolute tailspin. You know, my life is just I'm emotionally in shambles and spiritually in shambles, looking for something to believe in, you know. And, you know, then I hear like, and
it wasn't blowing in the wind, was it?
Absolutely, blowing in the wind. All those early songs.
The first time I heard that Dylan song, like it was like he gave me a new pair of eyes.
Yeah.
Like the lyrics and like what he was talking about, that might be one of my favorite songs of all time.
It is great. Masters of War, with God on our side. I mean, God, there's so many of them. And then you know, then Townes Van Zandt. Townes Van Zandt was what made me. It's like, okay, I'm gonna because. It spoke to me where I was at that time. You know, I was like, when you're feeling like you're waiting around to die, and then you hear the song "Waiting Around to Die," it helps you, man.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, damn, I gotta do this. And so, you know, just taking those guys in, just inspired, taking in all that inspired me to try to write my own songs, and I started trying to put whatever it was that was in my. Whatever it was I was feeling into songs, and most of those songs sucked, but it helped me at that time to release it in that way, and I started painting. I just started trying. I started doing everything I could to get what was disturbing me onto paper, into the air, and it was helping me. And so, I mean. You know, so you know, I say like that. You know, that music, you know, it had this salvation kind of effect for me. You know, because
mm-hmm.
my life was heading in one way, and what I found in it helped me turn it around. Then so I was writing songs from that point. I've been writing songs since then, about 2006, 2007.
Mm-hmm. What about I guess just to go into the art and songwriting and up to the day is, man, that Alabama Dares piece that you did.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, it cracked me up, and I guess that's what you made me think of when you said things that just disturbed me. It's like everything on that little wheel. Yeah. I was like, you couldn't have done it any better.
Yeah.
Like, the Alabama fans would... You know,
yeah.
This is their 10,000th title, or yeah. The education system,
yeah.
And
yeah, first in football, last in education, buddy. Alabama,
Roll Tide,
Roll Tide. Yeah,
but and just like getting familiar with your work and seeing that Alabama man, and just like some of the small things that you do, like with the snail on the tongue, and
yeah,
it's like that's it. And I don't have to, I don't need an explanation for that. I guess it's just living in Alabama and seeing that and, like, having stepped out of that echo chamber and back in it now. And I was like, that makes a whole lot of sense to me.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that particular piece, man, somebody gave me this, the middle of a clock,
uh-huh.
My old clock hand, and I was like, I'm going to put this in the middle of a... painting and making a board game, a dare, you know.
Yeah.
I'd painted a few of those things before individually, but I'd never put them together like that. But I had that at a big art show back in January. Mm-hmm. And that's where that one, which January now seems like 10 years ago.
It does.
Yeah, back in January I had a big show, and I debuted it there. And then as soon as I got it home, it was sold. Some of my best patrons, Paul and Lorraine, Paul Campbell and Lorraine Flanders. She's the head of the libraries over at University of South Alabama. But they've got a lot of my art, and they saw that piece and they were like, "We gotta have it."
Yeah.
So they got it. But I love doing that one. It was fun to demonstrate too.
Yeah, that video, that was a lot of fun to watch. And when he was breaking down each piece,
I ain't gonna have a
hard time talking to this guy.
Well, you know, some people it gets them a little upset, and other people, some people are decent enough to understand it. But you know, man, down here, brother, you got to be careful. I mean, you know, I don't give two shits about ever becoming a big famous artist in Alabama. You know what I mean?
But, yeah.
Yeah, if you do anything outside of the norm down here, you know, you've already limited your audience to a small number of people, because there's not a great deal of excitement about stuff like I do. But hey, man, whatever, you know.
Yeah, it is.
I find an audience for it elsewhere, you know.
Yeah, and so just with your songwriting, couple weeks ago or maybe a month ago, you would have been overseas.
Well, I was gonna be there in July. Yeah. Oh, I was over
there. For the thing that you played earlier today.
Oh, that thing. Yeah. That was an online thing, you know. Yeah, man. I've been over to Europe now. I've done two tours over there, and I was about to go do my third in June, the first week of June. Of course, that is not going to happen this year, and breaks my heart, but you know, we're all in it together. So
with your tour in the UK, and I'm guessing, I don't know all the type of venues you played in, but it would be like a listening hall type thing sometimes.
Yeah, like I play like small, well, specifically, if you're asking about the stuff I did in the UK, I was the opening act for this great songwriter by the name of David Ford, who in my estimation is probably one of the greatest songwriters alive. I mean, I think he's criminally under-recognized, but at least in the United States, and in England, he's a freaking rock star. So,
right.
Yeah, so... And a funny story is, on my very first tour to Europe, I was in the Netherlands playing a show. I think it was my last show of the tour, and I was opening for another American. And the American had this English, his name's Jared Dickinson, he's awesome, you should check him out. But there was a piano player with Jared who was an Englishman. And Jared was like, "Hey man, you want to go have some beers with us, you know, at the pub after the show?" I was like, "Yeah, dude." So I went there, and there was three of them. Jared, his wife, plays mm-hmm. with him, and David, who was his just like, I just thought he was a piano player. And so me and David just end up just hitting it off, man.
Yeah.
You know, we're just like just having beers, and very interesting. One of the most interesting cats. Like, it was like we knew each other in a past life or something. And because we just immediately connected. He was like, "Hey, you want to come open in my next run of shows in the UK?" And I was like, "Yeah." And I didn't even know who he was. I thought he was just a piano player. Yeah. So he got up to go to the bathroom, and I typed up his name into Google. It's like, I was like, "Oh, hell yeah, I want to go with your tour." And so we ended up touring. Dude, I played some big rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some big, like, cool rooms, man. We had... you know, I mean, I think a couple of shows there, we have busted 350 or something like that, you know. Played some killer halls, you know, music mm-hmm. halls. And it was an amazing tour, man.
Let's talk a little bit about the songwriting and the art.
All right, yeah, let's do it.
So, at what point, I guess, did you start believing in your songs to where you were open about playing out with them?
Well,
Because you mentioned earlier, like those first songs that you wrote, they were helpful to you, but you said they weren't good.
No, they wasn't good, man. I mean, really, I don't think. In my estimation, and this is no attempt at appearing to be humble, but I still got a long way to go, you know, to make the kind of... I'm always whittling at stuff. But what happened was, is I went to the desert in 2013 with the Air Force, and I left my wife. She was a couple months pregnant, you know, and then I went over there, and just that was another dark time, you know. It was just I landed over there, man. They let down that back of that plane, dude, and I started to walk off that thing, and the wind was blowing. It felt as hard as a damn hurricane, and the wind was so hot, it felt like somebody pouring a hot dryer on your face, you know, with sand and everything coming all in my eyes, and I was like, man, I want to go home. And then it's like, well, yeah, you ain't going home. And matter of fact, the quickest way for you to return, because I was like, I don't even care, I'm ready to go home. But then it's like, well, the quickest way for you to go home is to shut up, put your head down, do your job, and pray that everything goes all right, and then you go home. Because you can't quit. You know, there ain't no quit. And so, you know, it was just absolutely miserable. And then working 12-hour shifts, 6 days a week, you know, then going back. I'd play, we had a basketball court. I'd play basketball for a couple hours. I'd go to sleep, and that was my life. Mm-hmm. That was my life for 6 months. Well, you know, about 3 or 4 months into it, man, we're just sitting out. You know, most of our time on shift was just sitting in a tent. We're in a tent, sweltering heat, right? Looking out in a red horizon. And, you know, I'm just like, damn, I've not done anything with my life, you know? And if I, like the only thing I ever did with my life, back then I'd have been 33 years old. 2013, and you know, all I'd ever done with my life was bring negativity in the world through the kind of preaching that I did, and violence in the world through my service with the military.
What did that do to like your morality?
Well, that's it. It was compromised. You know, there's another thing is you realize. You know, I work on airplanes, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't pull triggers and watch bullets enter people's brains and kill them. I don't do that. But then when you go to the war, when we went into the desert, and you're seeing your planes being loaded with the instruments of war and death, and you see planes come back with injured people on them and caskets, and you're like, man.
And empty shells, right? They fired them bombs.
Oh, yeah.
You had a wrench on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. In a nutshell, that's it. And so, I went through a long period there where I realized that there's only bad guys in the world, that it's not like, you know, my grandfather was a World War II guy, and he fought under Patton, and there was a guy in Germany that was taking people and by millions and putting them in ovens. It's pretty justified to go over there and kick that dude's ass. You know, that dude should be killed and obliterated, mm-hmm. right? And like Japan, like they came over and they, you know, they kamikaze'd a whole bunch of ships and killed hundreds of men for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
those people should be brought to justice, right? I believe in violence if you have to use it to defend yourself, mm-hmm. or even in aid of others, right? like what Nazi Germany was doing. Those people had to be stopped. They were killing people by the millions.
That's for the heritage.
What's that?
For the heritage.
Yeah, it's just not right. And so, but then, you know, so when I joined the military, I had this idea of, like, the military, that's the kind of military I thought of, because that was, you know, it's just kind of what you thought. And then you get up and you realize, it's not like that. It's like, it's just meddling in all these affairs for oil and money and influence in regions over international politics, and it's just dirty. And defending anyone's freedom, I was not. You know what I'm saying? Defending my life or my family's life, that's certainly not what I was doing. And so you realize that when you're over there. And then so I fell out of love with that and totally went into another dark place in my mind. And I had been writing songs at this time, so this was 2013, so I'd been writing songs for 5 or 6 years. And so I said, you know, when I get home, if God will just let me get home, then I'm gonna start, you know, trying to bring something of beauty in the world. I wasn't even sure that my songs were any good. And it still took me, I didn't actually play my first song until 2015, but when I first came home, I had determined that I was going to try to do something to bring something beauty of the world in the world, because I started, when you're around death, you start thinking about your own death, you know?
Okay.
And you're like, if I die, like, what did I do? I didn't do shit, you know? I didn't do nothing. I was a failed preacher and a freaking military flunky, you know, who died another, who if I would have died, would have died in another meaningless war, you know? And so you know, since I've been home, I came home in 2014, my little boy Wyatt was born, and since that time, I've had one mission, man, and that's just, you know, do the best I can do to bring some beauty in the world. And honestly, like, everything before I came home, it's all meaningless to me, man. I don't, that, like, none of that stuff even matters. I mean, the only thing that was good, I had so much regret for many years, but the only good thing that came out of all that was it just gave me a platform, and it gave me certain experiences from which to create art, you know. Uh-huh. So I'm kind of thankful that I have had such a unusual experience now. I wouldn't recommend anybody do it, though, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, it helped me, give me a platform.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, man, I guess I'll ask you this, and
yeah,
we'll walk it on out the door. But
yeah,
with the media that you use with your art,
yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So I started painting, you know, at first just on wood or canvases or paper, or I started doing everything I could, just making stuff, right? Just mm-hmm. drawing stuff that, and then I came home, and when I moved back to Mobile in 2007, me and my mom was down in Gulf Shores, and at an art exhibit, I saw a painting that I believe to have been on tar. I had worked with tar for a little while when I was in college. I'd worked roofing houses, and I was like, man, that is a cool looking paint, because it has a texture to it, you know,
mm-hmm.
that has a certain texture. I was like, it looks like tar. And so I went home, and that day I went to Home Depot and bought a bucket of tar, and got some wood, and I mean, I got my first painting in the house in there, but I made my first painting, and then, you know, everybody thought I was crazy, because, I mean, I just quit the church, you know, and quit preaching after 9 years. Was pretty despondent. Wasn't connecting to a whole lot. And here I am, you know, in the garage painting these bizarre things. And I painted a big Judas Iscariot, you know, hanging on a tree. And that, you know, my family didn't really think that was all that great. And, which I totally understand, you know, looking back on it. But, and then I was painting like this. I've been painting like this on and off for a year. I mean, I'd made probably 50 or 60 paintings. And then I started playing music. 2015, I had my first gig. It changed my life. I started playing shows.
Was that the contest?
Yeah, it was a contest, yeah. And then in 2016, a record label was like, hey, you want to put out your record with us? I said, absolutely. So I put out this record label. They hired a publicist and a manager from me. And my publicist was Michelle Roche from Athens, Georgia. My manager was Jeff Wooding from Seattle. And they came to my house, and they were talking about how we're going to roll out my record. And I had one painting that my wife would allow me to hang in the house. All the rest of them were hid. And it said, welcome. It was by our front door. And as they were walking out, they said, who did this painting here? And I said, I did that. And they were like, oh, you paint? And I was like, yeah, nobody would ever like it. And they were like, oh, no, you're going to have an art show. And so I had an art show in February 2018. I had my first art show. And, man, since then, you know, I've had probably in the neighborhood of like 20 shows, I guess. And that would be 2 years and a couple months now. The Alabama Contemporary Art Museum has had my work. My work's been on a movie, a Stephen King movie, Dr. Sleep.
Yeah, that's a brand new film, latest one that come out by him.
Yeah, yep. Well, there's a guy, one of the bad guys, when he dies, he's got a shirt with my art on it. He dies, he's laying down, he's bleeding out. He's bleeding out of his head.
Cool, man.
Yeah, he's got his shirt says A. Partridge and my art on it. But, yeah, man, I sell a lot of art, man. I got a little art, started an art subscription service now. I got like 52 members, I think. And I send prints out every month to my subscribers. And I mean, you know, before this whole virus thing happened, I had a lot of art shows booked, man. A lot of them booked, but
yeah. It is what it is, right?
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully it'll, well, one of these days, I don't know if it's 6 months or 5 years, but one of these days it's going to be back, and I'm going to be back to doing it again, so yeah, I'll just be a little bit older. I have a lot more art, though.
There you go. Well, Abe, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with
me. Oh, yeah, buddy, thanks for coming by.
Have a conversation.
By. Yeah.
Last thing is just plugs. What are ways for people to find your art and music?
Oh, everything's on abepartridge.com. Okay. I'm also really active on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find me there. I put a lot of my art there. People sometimes write me, ask me how they can buy originals. It's best if you just watch my Facebook and Instagram feeds, because I put them on there. But abepartridge.com's got everything, man.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, man, thank you so much.
All right, thank you, buddy.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.